Sometimes you only work a little bit and you make a ton. Sometimes you work a ton and nothing pans out. There's certain personality traits that you want on your team. You're like, I'll train this guy to do whatever job, but I want to work with somebody like this. Like, they just give off good energy. The human brain is always going to come up with worst case scenarios, and it's going to be the most outrageous possible option.
Welcome, folks, to another edition of The Warrior Poet. Summer is ending where I am. The days are getting shorter. I may have missed the start of fall, but I am fairly certain it is still summer here. I'm working out like crazy because my shoulder just healed and it helps me stay in a good mood. Especially as the light goes down in quantity, it is great to get outside before winter really sets in. But regardless, good to stay healthy, right? There's another guy who likes to stay healthy. I saw on LinkedIn that he just raised a bunch of money for the Honor Foundation with a swim for SOF, meaning Special Operations Forces. His name is Kevin Seif, and I'm happy to have him on the podcast today. Kevin is an entrepreneur, investor, and former Navy SEAL. He was on the West Coast when he was in the SEAL teams. He also went to the Naval Academy. We didn't overlap. He studied oceanography there, a major that I have a passion for, even though I didn't major in it, and we talk a little bit about that today. Those of you who have been paying attention to some of the recent interviews will notice a recurring theme about hiring and recruiting and all things people, and perhaps it's obvious, but people is central to leadership. Without people, you're not leading anyone except yourself. Kevin, at his company Flintlock Solutions, does a lot of that kind of recruiting for top tier biotech companies, and so really wanted to pick his brain since he is one of the few people who's at the nexus of recruiting and hiring and going through candidate screening processes and things like that, and all the military leadership experience that yours truly has and many of the guests on The Warrior Poet. So without further ado, really excited. Hope that you enjoy this conversation with Kevin Seif.
Exactly. How you been?
Been doing well. Life's treating me all right. So business is still doing its thing. Got a couple good potential leads that are coming in that could swing us really in the right direction. By and large, we're still cruising along.
That's awesome. That's awesome, man. I'm glad business is going well for you. Even with the recession, how's that impacted your clientele?
Haven't noticed it. because they're all on. It'll be some lag because they're all on VC funding, or not all, but a lot of them are on VC funding. Their revenue stream is going to be a much smaller percentage of their anticipated runway. And so it'll be as VC funding starts drying up, maybe that they'll be like, okay, we weren't able to make, like, our fundraising was much smaller, or we didn't get fundraising, so we're going to go out of business, or we're going to cut back on hiring, whatever it is. We'll probably feel that in 6 to 18 months as their projected runway starts to change. But right now, everyone's still hiring, still moving forward. Some of them are like, hey, we need people now. We want to have them in by the end of the quarter or whatever it is. So for us, it really hasn't changed.
Cool. So I wonder if for biotech, which you serve to contextualize for folks, Kevin here is CEO of Flintlock Solutions, where you guys do sourcing, essentially recruiting for biotech firms, mainly in the VC space. Did I get that right, Kevin?
Yeah, so the early stage startup world, where most of the companies are reliant on venture capital funding to get things started, whether they're developing a product, developing a technology, developing a platform, the early stage. So some of them are as little as 3-4 people. Some of them are a couple hundred to even a couple thousand people. It just really depends where on the growth cycle they are.
Yeah, I wonder if for biotech, maybe they're just better capitalized up front, given that they know they need to do things for long life cycles. Same would probably be true of hardware. It just feels like, at least based on the last big recession, in 2008, which, you know, was a black swan event, but hopefully we'll have a little bit of a softer landing here. But it seems like software kind of is more directly impacted, like on an immediate basis, just because, you know, they've got customers who are feeling the pain and then not paying kind of on that immediate time frame. Like, I don't know if that resonates, if you kind of see the same thing.
Yeah, I think COVID was a big paradigm shift too, where, you know, since the late 90s, you know, with the initial dot-com boom going on then, and then through the 2000s and 2010s, people were just dumping money into the software tech space because there was so much money going into it. People didn't really understand how it was going. But I think after COVID and people were at home and they were realizing what's really important, they stopped investing in companies that make Candy Crush and, you know, the social medias of the world. They're like, let's put our money someplace more important, like in preventing pandemics and other diseases. So I think in 2020, that really kicked off venture capital investment in the biotech space. I mean, there's obviously been money here, but it's significantly increased over the last 3 years or so. And so I think that's what's keeping it afloat right now, is that people still want to put their money into something meaningful. You know, if you have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars that you're looking to put someplace, if you're just strictly looking at what the financial return is, yeah, maybe software is still probably a better bet. But if you're wanting to make, you know, get some good karma in return, you know, biotech, making people live healthier, longer, better, more meaningful lives, it seems like a much better space than investing in the next Facebook.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good segue to something else that I wanted to explore with you. For those watching on video, you're seeing a flag and a shadow box over stage left, Kevin's right shoulder there. Kevin and I were both in the SEAL teams, didn't know each other then, but something that I think about a lot and talk with other veterans about, Kevin, is purpose and dedication to what those in the military and first responders would call the mission. How have you found purpose post teams, post military? Obviously you've got the biotech angle there. Mm-hmm. You know, what else matters to you? Did you have any stumbles on the way to finding that?
I mean, it's been a continuous stumble. You just stumble forward instead of falling over. Ever since, I got out February 29th of 2020, leap day, big leap in my part. And for those of you who don't remember, 2 weeks later was when the country shut down. I think it was March 13th or something like that, that all the COVID restrictions started getting. I was like, oh, good. I've been out in the military for 2 weeks, and I don't know what would be worse, jumping out in a recession or jumping out in a pandemic. At least a recession, you kind of know what's happening. Pandemic, it was, we'll be hunkering down for 2 weeks and then two more and then two more. When I was getting out of the military, I really had no idea what I wanted to do. I liked the idea of a startup. You know, they represent the SEAL platoon, or they're very analogous to the SEAL platoon. You know, small team, very scrappy people, unified mission, people wearing multiple hats, higher risk tolerance, you know, to try and figure out a way to get things done. So the startup world was something I thought I wanted to be involved in. But I was going to do the typical military or even team guy exit. Yeah, let's get into operations, because operations and business has got to be the same as operations in the military, right? But as I started interviewing with companies, also big shout out to THF, the Honor Foundation. I was in cohort 26 with them here in San Diego. They definitely helped a lot, opened up a lot of different avenues, networks, and just perspectives on what you're able to get into next. Not every team guy has the same interests, has the same personality. You know, we all might look and dress the same with our gator sunglasses and our Suunto watches, but each of us has our own interests and goals that we're trying to pursue. So figuring out what it is I want to do next, they're a huge help. So Joe Musselman, THF, all you guys, thank you for supporting us. yeah, but even when I was going through that, I was going to do the operations avenue, and then I started interviewing for companies, and very quickly, fortunately, realized that is not anything I wanted to be involved in. I realized I wanted to focus more on an individual skill set and not just manage people, because I've been managing people for 12 years. So as that started coming about, I went into all the networking events and the discussions and all the things we did with a much more broad aperture of what else is out there other than just being an operations person. And I found out about recruiting, because going into it, I wanted nothing to do with sales, recruiting, HR. For me, HR was Toby from The Office. Like, hard pass. I'm good. But as I started talking to some outside recruiters, I'm like, this is actually pretty sweet. I get to chat with people all day. There's good financial incentives behind it. And it's very individually driven. You know, how hard you want to work. You can work 20 hours a week and make a little bit, or you can work 40, 60, 80, 100 hours a week and probably make a ton. It's really more dependent on you, but it is a variable scale. It's not just show up and collect a paycheck, which is something I wanted to get away from as I was getting out of the military. And as I was chatting with them, it seemed like it was going to be a good fit for me. And I like having conversations. I like meeting new people. And I found a recruiting agency that was founded by a couple of veterans, jumped on board with them. They were starting up a biotech team. And they're like, cool, you're in San Diego? We'll have you on that team, because San Diego is great for that. We'll have you wine and dine with the biotech people. COVID happened, so the wine and dining stuff went away, but I still was on biotech. And it just fit really well with me. All these guys, the scientists, these engineers, they know exactly what they're trying to do. They're trying to make people live better, healthier lives. And so I had that shared sense of purpose in what they're doing. I didn't go to school to be a scientist. I had 12 years in the military to learn how to talk with people, figure out value that they bring. I brought in work ethic, and you know, a lot of people, especially on that STEM side, don't like having conversations, don't like putting themselves out there. They're much more, maybe not introverted, but they don't like that social dynamic. So I'm here to bridge that gap between companies and these technically savvy people. So that's how I ended up in biotech recruiting. It took me about 10 months to realize that I also want to be an entrepreneur and start my own company.
I love it. I love it. Some people take a while to realize that. Some people realize it quickly. And some people, you know, do what they do, different strokes. Mm-hmm. Great to hear about the struggle there or the stumble forward. I definitely have had more than my fair share. Or maybe I earned that fair share, I suppose. So maybe it's plenty fair. I don't know.
I'm sure some of it's been self-imposed. We like to do that for ourselves. This seems hard. I'm going to do that.
Yeah, exactly. I know a few veterans who were at Amazon in the operations world, and it's kind of just and I had originally got recruited into Amazon on, you know, directly field operations. I ended up in ops tech, which was great. Interviewed a guy, Dave Glick, on a previous episode recently, who I worked with on the technology side. The field operations stuff, I think it plays to our skill set, but I think it's one of those things where just because you can do it well doesn't mean you should. And those guys ended up kind of beating their heads against the wall, because it's just like, I see this wall, I'm going to go through this wall. Maybe not for everybody.
One way frontal, advance forward.
Exactly. You brought up San Diego. I wanted to bring that up only because, selfishly, for the audience, San Diego is the best place on earth. And I it's been a while since I've been back, so I'm eternally jealous. And also, Kevin here is a Naval Academy grad like myself. And I saw on LinkedIn you did ocean engineering, which I've got a fellow SEAL, first guy that I worked for under was an ocean engineer. And I love it, man. Have you used any of it since? It sounds fascinating.
I can wholeheartedly say I haven't used my undergrad or my master's degree for anything other than saying I have one. I got drawn into ocean engineering because one of the one of the seniors in my company was an ocean engineer, and he was talking about how they're studying waves and surfing and other things. I'm like, ah, that'd be cool. Let's do that. I definitely got pulled into the group one majors, engineering. Probably should not have been. Probably should have been a group three, economics, international relations, which is what my master's is in. But yeah, I mean, it was exciting. It's good to learn the problem solving skills of being an engineer. So I'm not going to say I walked away with nothing, but I have noticed that. Well, I walked away from it knowing I don't want to be an engineer. So that's a huge win on my part. But I mean, it's cool. Like I'll go out surfing. I understand that the height of the wave means that it's basically that deep beneath it. So I know how deep the water is and what's going on. And I've always been a big ocean conservation person. Grown up around the coast my entire life. I love being out in it. So it resonated with me. It was something that I enjoyed, but don't want to be an engineer. Love working with them, but not being one.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. Whenever I become independently wealthy, I may have a second career as a marine biologist or something like that. All that stuff would be
Jacques Rousseau.
Exactly. Yeah. Or Steve Zissou from Life Aquatic. Yeah. I've got my beanie and my Speedo ready to go. You talked about kind of the, what you picked up in engineering. And I think there's probably, you know, I know we're kind of joking around. I'm sure there's some things there, that are like generalizable, right. That you've kind of picked and applied in certain places. And, I think we all have like this implicit knowledge and maybe we're not thinking about it where we learn this thing, but we apply it. I'm curious where in the recruiting world you believe Flintlock or you personally have differential skills. And, you know, I'm particularly curious kind of the skills that you took from the military. You know, what gives you an edge or what's your maybe different take? Like what is the recruiting world doing wrong?
The big thing with recruiting is that it's very similar to real estate. Everyone knows probably a dozen or more realtors, I'm gonna get them in there, because they have their real estate license and they do a couple deals a year. You know, not all realtors are created equal. Some of them will grind, they work, they have a huge network, they're reliable. There's someone that you'd want to recommend to your friends. Recruiters are very similar. There's very little barrier to entry. It's not prohibitive in any other way other than can you use some technologies like LinkedIn and email. What differentiates good recruiters from bad recruiters is people who put in the time and effort to actually screen through and not just spam a company with dozens of resumes of candidates who aren't qualified. And we take the burden on our end to heavily talk with candidates, build a good relationship with them, find out, you know, are they married? Do they want to move to a certain area? Are they looking to not move to a certain area? What price point are they looking to get? You know, actually understand who they are as a person instead of just saying, yep, talk to this person. They're interested in your company. Here's their resume. Go interview them. Anybody can do that. You're just playing a middleman there, collecting money for providing zero value added. Where we really distinguish ourselves is that because we focus on the early stage startup space, it's a very different clientele than, you know, if we're working for Genentech and Illuminate, big corporations, thousands of even tens of thousands of people. Some of that's going to excel in that type of world where there's significant structure and job security, and they know they come in, they start as a scientist one, they do it for a couple of years. Now they're a scientist two, do it for a couple more years, and they can. It's kind of like the military where you know this many years down the road, you're probably going to move this many times. You'll be at this rank, getting this pay. Some people thrive in that. They like to have the job security to be able to focus on their work and not worry about anything else that's going on. Then there's the people that enjoy the startup world where, yeah, you might come into this at this pay grade with this job description, but we're going to expect you to do 10, 20% more on either side. There's only going to be 10 people at the company, 20 people at the company. So you need to get along with everybody. You need to be able to communicate with all of them, understand what the big vision is. You need to have risk tolerance. You know that the company might not get funding next year, so you might end up looking for a job again. So we build our network around having candidates that not only want to be involved in that, but who thrive in that area. A lot of people like the romanticization. Can't say the word. It's romanticized to work in the startup world. And like, oh yeah, I go to startups. I make a lot of money because we get equity. I think it's 10% of companies actually make it from inception through some kind of exit, whether it's an IPO or an acquisition. So obviously the numbers are not in your favor, but people are excited about building something, not just finding a steady course. And so that's what we provide, is we know what type of people thrive in that environment, and we can give high reliability that they're going to do well once we present them to a client as a viable candidate.
There's probably a lot of people listening to this who are in a larger biotech firm, or maybe they're doing some totally different career, but they're doing the daily grind for a larger company, and they're looking for something that's a little edgier, where they're more fulfilled. You know, you talked about the giant leap you made on Leap Day a few years ago. What advice would you give to people who are on the brink of making that decision to make a big transition? I think everyone in the military has been through a bunch of them before the military, during the military, after the military. And so you kind of, I call it kind of, you know, being a new guy all over again all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, what advice would you give to people who maybe don't have as many reps with jockeying with such a decision and taking the leap?
I'm going to have to steal a line from Tim Ferriss on this one. He's talking about in his book, 4-Hour Work Week. A lot of people don't make that leap because the human brain is always going to come up with worst case scenarios. And it's going to be the most outrageous possible option. Like, this company is going to turn into the next Theranos, and, you know, we're going to go completely under, and then we're going to all get sued, and then I'm going to lose all my money, and I'm going to go to jail. It's like, no, first off, that's not going to happen unless you're that one person that is getting into it. But what Tim was saying was, come up with the worst possible realistic situation of what's going to happen, and then come up with the most realistic answer of what's going to happen. Like, yeah, sure, I do this career for a year or 2 years, and then they go under, and I find another job. It is no longer a black mark on someone's record for companies to see that you went to a startup, even if it was for 6 months. You explain to a hiring manager that, like, why do you only have 6 months at this one company? I heard about this cool startup. They're really interesting. They had a great vision of what they wanted to do. Unfortunately, there wasn't product market fit or whatever. They couldn't get funding, and they ended up going under. Learned a ton. Learned about how to build the business. Learned about interacting with small groups of people. About fundraising. I genuinely enjoy being a startup, and I want to go into another now. And so now you're carrying experience with you, as opposed to just saying, oh, I jumped jobs for 6 months. I have one candidate who for the last 5 years has been at five different companies. He had his first startup. He was there for a year and a half. They had an exit. They got bought out by a company. And they had four successive failures with companies. And the company that I'm representing them for now, they're like, why does he have so many career jumps? And I explained that to him, like, oh, this is great. He's learned a great deal. He knows exactly what he wants and doesn't want now, because he can say, these were bad experiences for this reason, but I enjoy these aspects of it. And they're bringing all that knowledge base. So to get to back to your answer or your question, you know, don't just look at what the possible negative outcomes are, because realistically, it's not going to be as bad as you think it is. If it's something you really want to do, give it a try. You can almost always recover from it. Very, very, very few situations, especially in the job market, are you not going to recover from.
Yeah, that's great advice. I will steal a line from Richard Feynman, who Tim Ferriss, I think, also quotes a lot, is, you know, don't fool yourself, and you are the easiest person to fool. So it's super easy to get into a decision and do the pros cons list, but you're, you know, like a newspaper editor with an axe to grind. You know, you're twisting what you are considering as facts to meet some sort of reality. And a lot of times it's emotional and distorted. You know, in that vein, I'm curious, like, a lot of these same people are probably feeling imposter syndrome either before they make the leap or after they make the leap. how do you deal with imposter syndrome? I think it's like one of those things where I don't think when we were kids, like the term even really existed in the public mind. But I think everyone realizes that we all deal with it at some point in life, maybe often in life. How do you deal with that?
I mean, I feel like I still deal with it. I felt like an imposter once I was in the teams, because you make it through buds and you get there. And then there's all these phenomenal athletes and operators that have done crazy. Because I got to the teams in 2012. I was a Marine for 4 years before that, came over later. And so a lot of these guys that I was working with have been in combat for 11, 12 years at that point. So the amount of experience they have, I did a couple of years in the Marines and kind of have some experience, but nothing compared to these guys. So the whole time I was there, I was trying to prove my worth. And then I get out, I start my own company, and I'm constantly trying to figure out what to do next. But the advantage I've had from working with a lot of these early stage companies is I get to work directly with the CEOs and the founding team members. And I've realized, you know, most people see CEOs like, oh, these guys know exactly what they're doing. They probably went to the top business schools and they've done all the stuff. They have a clear path of what they're going for. Now, most of these guys are figuring out as they go. My favorite line is that they're just like me. They're flying the plane as they build it. You can't come up with a perfect plan for how to build a company. The business world is just too dynamic. There's too many variables. The human psyche, human habits, there's just too much to actually predict. And so you can't have a step-by-step map of this is how we're going to go from building a company to IPO. It might be a general idea of how you can get there, but you have to be able to read and react and pivot. And you know, sometimes these companies realize that whatever product they had isn't going to be what they end up selling because it wasn't a good fit, but you can make something better out of it by shifting a couple degrees left or right and reading the market. So in terms of imposter syndrome, everybody has it. Nobody knows what's going on. They're all faking it till they make it. And you only see the success stories, but there's a lot of that iceberg that's not showing.
Yeah, totally. Totally. I once had a person who worked for me who said that the best advice I ever gave them, the thing that stuck with them the most was plan your dive and dive your plan. A motto from the SEAL teams about diving underwater at night with just a dive knife and your buddy next to you. And sometimes you feel bumps and it's not your buddy, it's from the other side. But how do we reconcile? Like, I was surprised, right? I thought that I had dropped a lot of wisdom and knowledge and other stuff coaching on this person over time. Obviously, I was giving myself probably more credit than I was due. But I was surprised that that was the one thing that stuck with them. Mm-hmm. And so how do we reconcile like that, whatever you want to call it, piece of wisdom, which I myself like to adhere by or adhere to, with what you're saying? Hey, like the business world is so dynamic. It's kind of like you can have a plan until you get punched in the face, right? The Mike Tyson mm-hmm. quote, which I'm completely mangling right now. So like what would your advice be to someone who's like, hey, I want to do a startup. I want to be a CEO. I've got this great idea for this life-saving technology. What would you tell them?
We're going to keep sparring back and forth with quotes. First off, quotes are great because you can cherry pick quotes that fit your narrative anytime.
Yeah.
I want to say it was Eisenhower said something like, plans are useless, but planning is invaluable. So just the fact that you sat down, you took the time to sit down and like, all right, this is our plan. These are the possible risks. These are the possible obstacles. These are going to be the ways we're going to get around it. The fact that you've taken the time to really analyze what you're getting into, you get a better understanding of what you're going to be undertaking. And from that, you'll be able to pivot back and forth. The Marine Corps is famous for, you know, we operate on a 70% knowledge base. You know, if you have 70% information, you're good to move forward because you're going to have to course correct once you get on scene anyway. Cause you know, nothing is as you think it is until you get on the ground. there's always going to be changes. Going back to the seal analogy, you know, you're going to think you have these great images of the target building, you know, exactly where all the doors are, and you get there, you're like, oh, that gate that we thought we'd be able to just climb over, that's 15 feet tall. That's very different than what we were expecting. Or that's not actually a door. That's just a piece of plywood leaned against the wall that we thought was a door. So you have to read and react once you get on the ground. But the fact that you took the time to analyze either the target or the product, whatever it is you're trying to do, you have an overarching understanding of what's going to be going on. So you're able to read and react. Like, okay, that one's not good, but we can go around to this window. Or we brought ladders so we can still climb over this, whatever it might be. But definitely go in with a plan. Know that plan is going to change. And another big Marine Corps saying was, don't plan in a vacuum. Bring your team on board with you. Make sure they're aware of the plan. Otherwise, you're going to end up micromanaging. If everyone understands what the end goal is going to be, then they can read and react on their own, and things can move much more organically and quickly because everyone's moving towards the same end goal. And they don't undervalue your people. They're going to be able to make smart decisions too. So if you give them the ability and the knowledge to do it, you'll be pleasantly surprised with how well people adapt.
Hey, gang. Hope you're enjoying this episode of The Warrior Poet. If you are, don't forget to subscribe so I can get you more thoughts on leadership, interviews with military experts and business phenoms, as well as other hacks to up your game in your daily life. And please leave a review. Let me know what I'm doing well, which interviews you liked, and if you like the philosophical musings, footnotes, or critiques of throwback music. Back to the interview.
Yeah, that's priceless advice. I also think sometimes that I take for granted when I think about like that conundrum, how the SOPs and the long training cycle that we had together before deploying and all the rehearsals, like all of those little scripts that we all have, and like we're all on the same script. And they're just automatic. So like the fallback plans just become kind of seamless. Whereas, you know, for anyone who's, you know, going into a startup, I'm not saying don't do it by any means, but you're not going to have all those scripts, you know, that everyone can run from, because chances are, you know, your first hire is like, you just met them a couple weeks ago. So I don't know if you have anything to add on that. And then, you know, probably more, even more important in your world when you're filling out like a C-suite or, you know, senior VPs in a company, like tricky to mesh people together, obviously. Right.
Yeah. And to get to your point on, you know, figuring out what the company's going to do. One of my favorite examples is one of my clients called Zia Biosciences. They started out, the CEO developed an indoor growing methodology to grow lettuce, because he's like, lettuce is, like millions of dollars are bought year round with lettuce, but you're dealing with pests, you're dealing with weather, you're dealing with all kinds of variables in the outside world. So you're like, I wonder if you can just grow this indoors and sell it. But he's like, they realize that there's not a whole lot of profit margin with growing lettuce. So then they had a very strong platform, the essentially growing hydroponic lettuce. They designed all their own lighting systems and the nutrient mixtures and all these things that in itself was extremely valuable, but for the product of lettuce turned out not to be great. So then they shifted to nutraceuticals. So thinking of all like the natural supplements you take, you know, the mushroom supplements and all those other fancy things that you go to Whole Foods and spend half your paycheck on because they're like $20 for this bottle of 10 pills. That brought it from like a 1 or 2, like 1.5 to 2x profit margin to about a 10 or 15% profit margin. Like, well, we can do this, and we really fine tune the process, and we enclose it in a clean room. Then we can start actually growing pharmaceutical drugs inside the plants. It's been around for years, but there's been too much variation to pass FDA standards. But they came up with a methodology to do that. So again, from that same lettuce platform, they're now growing drugs inside of lettuce, which has a 50 to 100x profit margin based off of what they can get approved. And they own the technology and how to do it from start to finish. And so it's, you know, if he wasn't an adaptable person that could see what the market's driving and what the value is, he'd still be growing lettuce, you know, making, I'm sure they'd still do fine as a company. You know, there's a ton of interest in indoor growing right now, but the fact they've been able to go from 2x to 100x potentially is indicative of how a good leader can dramatically influence the outcome of a company.
That's an awesome example. I was not aware of them. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
One thing I really wanted to pick your brain on is how to hire better. I think hiring is one of those things where it's like driving. Everyone thinks they're a great driver, but statistically speaking, not everyone can be above average, right? And there's a whole bunch of studies on this for people listening at home who want to nerd out about this. I think hiring is the same thing. Everyone thinks they know what a good hiring process looks like, know what a good candidate looks like. And it's also akin to kind of hunches in police forces, which are like, notoriously wrong, and especially like with the advent of DNA and CSI and all that sort of stuff, has kind of borne that out. I think recruiting is one of those things that we're like, lives aren't on the line, you know, like they are if you're a bad driver or if you're a bad police force. You know, there are humans involved, but like, I think a lot of the costs just go beneath the radar or take a long time to pan out. But eventually you get attrition. So companies see it. They pay, you know, senior HR people, heads of people, you know, amazing amounts of money to occupy those kind of C-suite positions, especially at more mature companies. But it's not obvious that they know how to solve this either, from at least from what I've seen in a few places. So like maybe we could start from the top. Like, what makes a good interview process?
So to really start at the top, it's why hire a recruiter? And I use the analogy of hiring a painter. Anybody can go to Home Depot, buy all the supplies, and paint their own house. But ultimately, you're probably going to spend more money than you would have because you're going to have to buy all the supplies for one-time use. It's not going to look as good because you've only done it the one time. And it's invariably going to take you longer than if you just hired somebody to do it, because you're going to have all kinds of obstacles in the way that you didn't anticipate because you don't do this very often. But yes, you can do it on your own and it'll look fine. The job will get done. But more importantly, what else could you have been doing with your time? Recruiting is extremely time intensive, because especially if you put up a job ad, you're going to get all kinds of unqualified people applying. LinkedIn has made it far too easy just to click apply, click apply, click apply. We get people all the time that they're not even in the same industry, and they just applied to this, you know, production associate role, and they're like a data analyst. But so now you have to screen through these resumes, screen through their profiles, have a conversation with them, figure out if they're even qualified through talking with them, if they're qualified, interested, up to the location, what their pay range is, you know, what their end goals are. Are they looking to even go down that career path that this role is going to put them into? So you can do all that on your own, but especially if you're like a 10-person company and you're the CEO, what else could you be doing with those hours, 10 hours a week that you would be spending on recruiting? You could be fundraising, you could be getting your message out there, you can be doing marketing, you can do so many other things with your time that it is a much more high dollar value. So that's why you hire a recruiter. And that's why people have internal recruiters, because you need to have somebody that is going to put the company first, that's going to make sure these people get filled properly, but not take up a ton of time on the founder's part. But in terms of once you start talking with people, you screen them out enough to know that they're a viable candidate. I try and impress this on my clients so much. Hire for soft skills, train hard skills. Because the soft skills like communication skills, how well they get along with people, what their work ethic is, are they a lifelong learner, Are they willing to do things that may seem beneath them, like, you know, in the teams? Are you going to sweep out the gear cage and take out the trash? There's plenty of people out there like, that's not my job description. I'm not going to do it. There's certain personality traits that you want on your team. And you're like, I'll train this guy to do whatever job, but I want to work with somebody like this. Like, they just give off good energy. Yes, in biotech and in the sciences, you're going to have to still have some foundational level, but don't be so quick to screen people out because they don't have the perfect list of experiences. You know, they didn't work at this company. They haven't worked in this specific, you know, fermentation process. You know, they've worked with yeast, but not E. coli or something like that. A lot of companies, they just want to find that perfect candidate that's a very quick plug and play, and you can forget about it. Because once you bring them on board, of course, they're gonna be able to do everything perfectly. But especially in the startup world, where so many companies are creating a new technology, a new platform, a new drug, whatever it is, that key word right there is it's new. Whoever you're going to bring on board is going to have to figure out what this new stuff is. And even if it's as simple as you guys do this process a little different, or you document it this way, or they need to talk with these people to make sure that everything's lined up and everybody's on the same page. Like, there's always going to be a learning curve. So you can never have a situation where you're going to bring someone in and it's going to be fire and forget. If that's your leadership style, you're going to fail as a company. You can't just bring someone on board, say, go after it. You've done this before. Make us lots of money. You have to invest in them. And honestly, if you bring someone on that isn't a perfect fit and you train them, you invest in them as a person, you're investing in your own company's future, because they're going to be that much more likely to stay on board. They're not going to leave after a year or two. So like, oh, these guys invested in me to become a better scientist, become a better engineer, become a better salesperson. Of course I want to stay here. Even if someone else offers me more money, money is kind of it's a nicety. People get real wide-eyed about it. But ultimately, I've been in roles where I made plenty of money and I was bored and I wanted to get out of it. Money's nice when everything else is in line. So they need to be happy with their job, feel like they have a purpose, feel like they're providing value to a company. So if you can do that on the front end, you can teach them the rest of the skills. So the shorter answer is hire people that you can invest in, and it'll be a high rate of return on that investment versus just finding that easy button answer.
Yeah, you could see me smiling there as you're talking about the soft skills aspect. I think some guests on the show so far, other team guys, you know, outside of the show, it seems to really resonate with people from the military. How do you test for that? So I think you and I have some things in mind. We have some experiences that we lived through, and I suppose based on the results, thrived in and succeeded at, made it out the other side. So maybe that makes us biased that the process was good because we made it. How do you do that in the business world? You know, I think Rich DeVinny on the show talked about, like, you know, you can't send people to sit in the cold surf for hours at a time in the business world. What do you frowned upon, right? What do you do? What are the best companies that you work with and yourself in your process do to test for those soft skills? And for that matter, what are the key soft skills for people out there that they should be looking for?
Yeah. So the big ones that I frequently see are going to be lifelong learners. Can they communicate, and, you know, work ethic? Outside of that, there's going to be a dozen or more things that you can look for, but it's all going to be depending on the situation. Lifelong learner is an easy one. Ask them, what was the last book they read? What was the last, whatever, in a, find out what their hobby is, find out how they've, what they've done to better themselves in that area. You know, do they, for me with the biotech space, you know, are they reading scientific journals? Do they read books? Do they research things on their own? You just ask them about any of those? What was the last thing you researched on your own? What was the last book you read? What was the last scientific journal you read? If they struggled with that type of question, maybe you need to find an avenue that they, do they watch videos on YouTube to get better at certain skills? Not everyone likes to read, which is fine. But just find out what have they done to better themselves. And actually, the pandemic, it makes it very easy. You can say, during the pandemic, what did you do? What skills did you come out with during that time while you were stuck at home? If in this case they were stuck at home, did you become do you learn how to brew beer? Do you make your own coffee now? Did you pick up carpentry? Did you start training for a marathon? What did you do with your time to better yourself when you weren't being told by someone else what to do? And then for communication skills, just have a conversation. Don't have an interview of me ask question, you answer question. Me ask question, you answer question. It's a very awkward stance. No one enjoys interviews, interrogations, any of that stuff. You're always going to get very canned answers. You're never going to get a natural flow. So always try to, when possible, just have a conversation with the person. Ask them about their career, how they got started in it, and just make it more of a story instead of, I have these questions and I need to get answers to, and so I'm just going to go back and forth with this because I myself can't hold the conversation, but I'm going to expect them to have strong communication skills. It's kind of hypocritical. And then the work ethic, you can just through conversation, you can hear what time do you show up to work? Do you work on the weekends by choice? Do you have a work-life balance? What do you do to balance that? What does your daily routine look like? Do you wake up and take the dogs for a walk and have breakfast with your family and then work for these times? Or are you someone that you immediately wake up, check your phone, start working, you ignore your family, you've been divorced 5 times? I'm not saying don't hire someone because they've been divorced 5 times, but dig into what it is that they're doing with their life to find balance in it. Because even if they're the best scientists, if they keep getting into marriages that fail, if they don't have any hobbies on the outside, if they don't have anything that sparks interest in them, they're probably going to get burnt out and they're not going to be a good employee. So you want to find people that have that work-life balance, not because it sounds cool and you can tell everybody on social media that our employees have work-life balance. It's just healthy for the individual. They're gonna come to work every day recharged and wanting to work. They're gonna put in extra effort. They're gonna be able to stay with the company for the long haul and not have personal issues constantly coming up. They're not gonna be getting sick as much. Are they working out? They'll probably be healthier individuals. And so it just makes them all more reliable, better employees. And I hate to use the term more productive, but ultimately, if you're a healthy, balanced person, you're gonna be more productive because you're happy to be doing what you're doing.
Yeah, I love how you ended that. The same thing was going through my mind in terms of having that health and that balanced person, strong sense of self is kind of the phrase that I use for finding that mm-hmm. person who's gonna be with you through the hard times and come out the other end. Not too much time left here. Definitely want to hit on patterns you've seen out there that work and patterns you've seen that don't work. So obviously you're kind of on the outside, but you work very closely with your clients and mm-hmm. Even though, like you said, there's romanticization about startups and biotech and technology and VC and all that sort of stuff. There are a lot of people who are doing really great things, pushing the bound in terms of all sorts of process. Right. And so sometimes it does live up to the hype, but then there's lots of horror stories to go with it. So you've probably seen both sides. I know I have. What makes for a bad hiring process, either for the candidate or for the company themselves, and they don't get what they bargained for? And then maybe what are your best clients do to change things up?
Yeah, I mean, the easiest answer to that is the clients that don't have a hiring process. They're like, oh yeah, we'll talk to people and we'll interview them and then we'll hire them. And so whenever we bring on a new client, I always ask them, what is the process that you're going to go through? Well, actually, for every single role, even if they've already been a client, I always ask them, what is the process for this? They're going to probably have a phone screen with you and then maybe do a voice panel or sorry, a video panel with a couple of team members, and they'll come in for a presentation either over video or on site. But I want to know specifically who they're going to talk to, what they're going to talk about, what the candidate needs to prepare for that. Because not so much that I want to, although I do want to feed this information to the candidate, I want to know that they've put thought into it. Because the worst case, and we just ran into this with one company, is when they don't have a plan, either it shows that they're a little bit disorganized or hiring is not a priority for them, which can lead to it being a slower process. Because a lot of companies, they forget the fact that this person has a life outside of hiring. They're not just put on this planet to interview for this role, and then if they don't get it, they kind of go off and never exist again. A lot of these people already have jobs, so they're taking time out of their day, out of their work schedule, where they could be spending time at work or with family, to talk with you. So you should value their time. And you can, the best way to show that you value their time is to have a clear, concise, effective process that isn't spanning over weeks and weeks. Even for C-suite executives, we've gotten them hired within a month. And these guys are talking to the CEO. They're talking to pretty much every board member. They're talking to investors. They need to meet with some of the people on the team. Like, they have a very extensive hiring process, and they can still get it done within 4 to 6 weeks. If you're hiring a mid to entry level person, that should be 2 to 3 weeks max. You should be interviewing your people, have a clear process. The people who are involved in that process need to have time allocated to do this, so it's not getting pushed down the road because so-and-so from whatever department doesn't have time. If you want to hire, make the time for it so the process is quick, because this is the first experience a candidate has with your company, and they're going to be able to judge a lot about how companies run based off this process. If it's, we talked with this person, it was 45 minutes exactly, they started on time, we had a great conversation, they followed it up with an email saying, we're going to schedule you for this next interview, and things just move quickly, they're like, this is an efficiently run company. They know what they're doing. They value my time. They're putting on the veneer that they've done this before. Whereas if you come in, they started late, there's all kinds of issues, the conversation's awkward, there's week, 2, 3 week delays between conversations, that candidate's going to start looking elsewhere real quick. So if you're hiring for people, have a plan, implement that plan, make sure everyone involved in it is aware and has time. You give them time to be able to do these interviews to get things done quickly.
Awesome. That's super useful advice for all the companies out there. As we wrap up here, Kevin, super awesome having you on here. You deal with a lot of, you know, what I'll call the rest of us, right? So all the people in the candidate pool, you know, who aren't running companies, who aren't CEOs or hiring managers, you know, just James and John's out there who probably look up to you and really benefit from your mentorship along the way. I know that's something that all of us, you know, in the veteran community take seriously in terms of developing people. So anything you want to leave the audience with, would love for that from you. And then where can folks find you?
Yeah, I think I go back to that topic we were talking about earlier. And take risks and find things that are meaningful. Life is too short to be stuck doing something you're not enjoying, that's not giving you purpose or meaning. You can almost always recover from a bad decision. But make the decision to go out and push your limits, try something new, try something that you've been wanting to do for a while and just never had the courage to do. It's a lot easier. Even starting your own company. I had zero experience in the military. They did not train me at all to be an entrepreneur. That is like the antithesis of the military. But you know, I took a leap, and it's been a great decision. I enjoy building something myself. I enjoy sharing that experience with the people that have been generous enough to join my team. And so I can't stress enough how fulfilling it is to do something that you've been wanting to do.
That's awesome, man. Well, Kevin Seif, thanks a lot for joining the podcast here, man. Be well.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Warrior Poet is a property of Rainiac Productions. If you like The Warrior Poet, there's more great content on Instagram. Follow Shri, The Warrior Poet, on Instagram. That's S-R-I, The Warrior Poet. You can also get to know me on a personal level by following Shri, actually, on Instagram as well. The Warrior Poet is produced by Laddie, with special contributions by Spoonman and me, Shri.
No, 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 no. Kevin, me na dua. Spita.